Let's go down to the Urban Homestead, Pasadena by the freeway. Right down there on the Urban Homestead, Jules and his family are working away. Come on down to the farm in the city, back to the future, back to the plan. Right down there on the Urban Homestead, loving the life back into the land.
Oh, ooh, help the garden grow.
Singing,
oh, ooh,
we've got to help the garden grow.
Welcome to the Urban Homestead Radio. We are your hosts, Anise,
Justin,
Jordan. Folks, thanks again for tuning in. Today we thought we'd talk about why we do what we do. And we like to share some stories and some history behind where we are today. So, Justin.
Yeah, well, we just got through with Little Mo yesterday, and he was talking about his family history, how music and acting was in his blood. And I'd like to say that gardening, horticulture is in our family for 3 or 4 generations. Going back to Belgium, they ran nursery, landscape, business, and numerous greenhouses. And sounds familiar. Sounds like a family enterprise, became well known. They developed new rose species, became trademarked, and from which also landscaped the palace of King Bedouin. The family also received a degree in horticulture, and that was in Belgium. But later, he had was a great-grandfather? Yeah, great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. Great-grandfather had a chance to immigrate. So it was either the Belgian Congo or Florida. And they chose Florida.
For the hunting.
Specifically for the good climate, because it was still wide-open frontier stocked with wildlife. The whole family enjoyed hunting and fishing. They say the rest is history, but
they ran a nursery, planting grounds.
Yeah, I think so.
He supervised landscape. Let's see where else would go.
Landscaped.
Ballast Point Park.
Ballast Point Park.
Yeah. Yeah. So
what was the story that Dad would tell, that he met somebody that came to our property by honey
in Florida? 10 acres in Florida.
Yeah, yeah, and he said, "Are you related to
Darvays?
The Darvays from
Ballast Point here.
Ballast Point, because he said the rows were
so straight. Everything was even and straight line.
Perfectly straight.
And he ran into the grandson, our dad, at his nursery at, what was the name of it? La Casa Verde?
La Casa Verde.
La Casa Verde, one of Dad's first forays into self-employed businesses. So that came passed down a generation.
Yeah, so we've had, I think there was a lark. Or a tree.
Yeah, there's several varieties named after the family, so, specifically, and then also.
And they're on the Latin names.
Yeah, Latin names. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so basically,
it's genetic. Yeah, we got a green thumb from way, way back.
Can't help it.
I think I remember, when I was a kid, we had 10 acres in Florida, but, we always had a garden. But I wanted Dad to clear out me a little patch because I wanted so bad to grow flowers. So I was like, please, 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 can I have a little spot so I could grow flowers? And so I just always would collect flower seeds, plant flower seeds and things like that. So it was just always wanting to plant something from
you
early
really
age.
Say that you don't want to grow up to be a parent. With gardening, it was always, you couldn't help it. We always had some growing something as a kid, and I did that here because I grew up here. I was always growing plants and cuttings, and it was just a natural. I didn't have any, it wasn't like
work.
Work. You naturally were planting. It was no, like, learning anything. It was just in your genes, in your genetics.
Yeah. Because our grandfather, they had, you couldn't see his house from the street. And you can't see our house from the street. So.
You couldn't see our great grandfather's house.
It started out with grass, and slowly the grass went away.
So it ended up. They want to know if Grandpa was working in the yard in his old Chevron overalls, and they want to know who owned the place.
He was like me.
They thought he was the gardener. He's out there in Florida.
And he developed crotons.
He was in the newspaper because of the crotons.
Because of his crotons.
That's our grandfather.
These tropical plants that very colorful, and he would develop his own variety. People actually stopped and asked if he sold them. He never actually marketed it.
People actually stopped and asked me, people actually literally came in the night and
stole them.
Dug them literally out. I remember spending the night at my grandfather sometimes, and he'd go out in the morning, he's like, oh, somebody's been in the yard again. They dug out, 10 or 20 of them. They'd come in and dig them out because they were so beautiful. And I'm always doing new things. And then,
you're talking about what passed down from the generations, even unknown to us, was a. You talk about they lost two kids at one time. Mm-hmm. There was a. In Florida, it's hot and humid, and every time we would get. We'd be kids playing, be sweating up a storm, we'd get in the car, everybody wanted to roll down the windows. And our grandfather said, close the windows. Our dad said close the windows, and we couldn't figure out why. What was the deal with closing the windows?
It's like obsessive closing windows.
Yeah,
like
OCD. OCD basically is, it's hot, it's humid, you're sweating. Roll down the windows.
Do not roll down the windows.
And we didn't understand. It's like why they wouldn't let us roll down the windows. Our grandfather wouldn't let us do it. Our dad wouldn't let us do it.
Dad
didn't know. So then we finally found out that our grandfather's sister died. Because she cooled off too fast.
In an open
air streetcar.
Well, she had just played a basketball game.
A high school basketball
game. And she went home on the trolley or streetcar, and she cooled down so fast that she got pneumonia, and she died. So that's why we would hike in the mountains, and it would be hot, and we'd get in a hot car, and we want to roll down the windows.
And Dad was he never explained why. He didn't know until we found out.
Until he found out years later, it was a traumatic experience that was passed down. Don't cool off too fast. Nobody explained it. Until years later, we figured out. Somebody explained why the windows would never roll down, even though you were hot, hot and humid in Florida. I mean, it's like brutally. And that was something that passed down through generations.
It'll probably pass on.
It's happened in a lot of families. They said why they have that happens is something traumatic happens. Mm-hmm. And they unfortunately got the green thumb, but it's a personal story.
There was a for a while there. I looked online for memorabilia related to the Dorvay's family nursery that existed in Belgium. My dad actually saw it when he went back to Belgium. My mom and dad both saw it. Was mm-hmm. the '70s. It existed. It had the name on it. They sold it, and
college had to be before that, right?
Yeah, but mom saw it too. Oh. So after that, and so I for a while there I researched for memorabilia related to the Dorvay's nursery, and there's quite a lot. It's sold on eBay, magazines, catalogs, mm-hmm. rose books with the names in it, and there was one time I wanted to bid on this catalog that was on eBay. And so I bid on it, but I lost it to someone else. And I'm like, who wants a Dorvay's family catalog? And so I wrote him on eBay, and he wrote back a story, which I should find again. He says, the Dorvay's family is, legendary. That he collects everything related to the Dorvay's family nursery. And I'm like, I need to visit you, because I need all that. And he told a story about how everybody talks about them and how the nursery was so legendary, all the royalty of Europe would come just to tour the growing grounds of the Dorvay's family nursery. And they would take the princesses of, like, Spain up on these airplanes and fly over the growing grounds and, like, name roses after them, you know, right and left. And so he wrote this beautiful story. I saved it. And he was like, anything else you want to know? He collected all memorabilia. So I have a couple cards, like mailers. I think my earliest catalog I found goes back to 1909. And it's all in Flemish. And this is 1905. And yeah, so they would do like the exposition, world's fairs, mm-hmm. and all that. They were like the royal horticulturists mm-hmm. of Europe. All the European royal and families would come.
They landscaped the palace grounds
of King Bedouin.
And, they would keep that. So.
Supposedly there was a plaque put, but I haven't got that confirmed. I have to go. We have to go to Belgium. Supposedly. But
So, yeah, you wanted to read something?
Oh, yeah. We'll fast forward in a bit. We're going through some family history. It was 19...
What was it? 19, what is it?
19, you want to read it?
73.
Oh. This is a letter my dad wrote in 1973. He saved it. The original copy is somewhere, and he told us this is what he wrote as soon as he was 25. He put, actually, I am 25 and a half. So this is Jules Darvish Jr. in 1973. He wrote this note to himself. Was he out of college? When did he graduate?
He graduated 69.
69. So I think he...
He wrote this in New Zealand because he went to New Zealand in 1972. Started homesteading, but he was writing down like personal notes to himself, like why and what was he doing this for.
So this note is from 1973. He wrote, "To live as simply as possible, to live in harmony with nature, all things are possible to a certain extent. The modern technological world has made its people its subjects. It has made them ignorant and keeps them in ignorance. We are basically ignorant, ignorant of the basics. Where does our food come from? Where does our water come from? And importantly, where do our wastes go? We live cut off from ourselves because of this lack of touch with the natural things, and our foundation is weakened, and there's no way we can build onto the self in such a state. So I must go back as far as I can. I must find out where to get water to drink. Can I afford to wait any longer to begin this backtrack? Should I gather more accessories and build up a secure foothold first in this world? What do I need? I need only land and water so I can live. Why do other people want more? And why do other people want me to have more? I want less and less. If I'm alive and learning, what more? I need to learn how to grow food. How long should I wait to do this? I am 25 and a half. And he signed it, Jules Darvish Jr. in 1973. So that is where he pretty much, I think he wrote his entire philosophy down on a paper. And he, as the dad I knew, kept to this.
And then what I used as on the handout to the memorial was two quotes, and a lot of people wrote me because I'd used one of his quotes to tell people of the memorial, and I used one of his quotes, and people wrote me and said, your dad's quote and is true because I have done this. And so I don't know when it was written, but he said, "I measure short-term success by how much I have improved at what I'm doing to make my world a better place. However, I see long-term success as being measured by what others have accomplished because of what I have done." So we got so many letters these past couple months, so many cards, so many emails, so many things on Facebook written about how, our family has inspired their family, or how we have inspired people to just do something with their lives. And that's been very inspirational to us too, and very humbling, because we just, I think sometimes we don't realize how many people we touch because we're busy with our daily lives. And then when an email comes in or a comment, and we haven't even got to reading all the Facebook comments, it was just too overwhelming. Of just everything. So yeah, I think Jordan wants to share one that we got from the Netherlands, I think.
Yeah. I actually have not read this. I pretty much many months, and still to this time, I don't I don't really read the letters that we receive. I appreciate them, but it's a little too personal at the moment. A little overwhelming, but there was this letter. I don't have the opportunity to attend your father's memorial as I live in Norway, but I am writing to you. The quote, which Annie's just said, made me want to give you a short update on how your father has influenced my life, half across the globe, even though I have never met him in person. I first came across a YouTube video 5 or 6 years ago of how he transformed his tiny lot right next to a freeway into a Garden of Eden. I had just started to get interested in gardening and growing a little food in my own garden when I witnessed how your father had turned his limited garden into an ecologically healthy paradise. My house is right next to a thoroughfare, not a highway, but I immediately thought, if he can do that much with so little, I can definitely make my own yard, which is slightly bigger than yours, into a diverse food-producing garden. I have been working steadily and patiently on this task every year since then, and my garden now includes chickens for eggs, a greenhouse of repurposed windows, as I live in a cold climate, and a steadily growing amount of beds where seasonal vegetables are rotated on a yearly basis. I wish you all the luck in your future endeavors to honor your father's legacy, and hope you remain steadfast in your continuing work for a better world. My name is Jeanette.
Yeah, it's like I said, still get emotional over that, and just there's so many of them, and just them reaching out to us really meant a lot these last couple months, and we really appreciate that, because you know we do want to continue. You know, farm work is never done, and we feel like, oh, you know, sometimes like, oh, you just stay in bed, it's a little overwhelming, but the chickens need to be let out. No matter what, you know, no matter what, and the seeds need to be planted, otherwise there will be no harvest. So that life, the living that's around you, keeps you going. Even though, you know, things in the world might not look so good, even though sometimes your own life might not look so good, in terms of just, you know, the struggles. But it's the homestead life, the living things around you that keep you going, that propel you forward, even though sometimes you don't want to be, or if you don't feel like you want to, because it's just sometimes overwhelming. Yeah, so that just keeps us going, keeps putting one foot in front of the other.
We had a little recharge from the rain this year, too. God is excited. After 5 years of drought, I think it got us back to being how the yard used to look when it rained every year. So last night, Saturday morning, and last night, we got the first measure of the rain in like 2 months.
Yeah, I mean, we're just 90, all 90 last week.
90, really some, yeah. 92, 90, and then finally broke and we got rain on Saturday morning and Sunday day.
Yeah.
So that helped a lot. You can tell the difference between all the, everything sort of took off after that.
Yeah, I mean,
that late in the season.
Yeah, just people are still, like even today, I was at a cafe and people came up and said, oh, you know, I've been to your classes and sorry about your dad and, you know, hope you, you know, wish you well and hope you're continuing and things like that. So we...
Is that on top of the one from Saturday?
No, that's not even the one on Saturday. That was another lady that came up to us. So it's just, Pazzi is a small community, I mean, surprisingly, and people just, you know, still coming up to us even to this day, and it's nice to see that. And, you know, they all want to know how the farm is doing, and even though, you know, somewhat behind on certain things, but we just continue to bugger on.
This one was from Kansas. This is a letter from a woman in Kansas City. You know, she wrote, condolences on our father's passing, and says, I would be praying for you each and every day, as I have since I first read about your dad. Your dad changed the world. I remember your first YouTube video about your homestead, and when the song played, What Kind of World Do You Want? I wept. It was so touching. I often replay that notion in my mind as I make my daily choices. We each create the world we want by the choices we make. I thought you, your dad, you three were awesome. Another thing I learned when I first learned of a loved one passing is to enjoy being with one now gone. First thing I thought about was how I first found your dad. He was on YouTube, I think, in a black and white video someone had filmed at UCLA. I still use his line, You can buy more different kinds of tennis shoes than you can buy tomatoes in the grocery store. In fact, I think I said that just twice in this last week alone. And when he held up that Trombosino squash and talked about the perpetual soup, I loved it. I still grow the Trombosino from the seed I originally got from you guys. When people say they never heard of it, I used your father's line. You can't buy this in the grocery store. What would they put it in? Paper or plastic? It wouldn't fit in either. And just to clarify, the Trombosino squash, some people have seen it on our websites, like, can grow 6 to 8 feet long. Big, long, looks like a trumpet. My husband and I watch these videos often. We didn't know your dad's name, so we called him the white-haired guy from UCLA. Sometime later, we found you folks, and we followed your blog, Anais, faithfully, and learned so much from your family's journey. One day, I discovered that the two men we thought so highly of were the same man. I remember running upstairs to my husband's den, and I was so excited I could hardly speak. Honey, the white-haired guy from UCLA is Jules Dorvaise. He did not believe me until we both pulled up the UCLA tapes and then the new blog we had recently found. We were thrilled and delighted. I know it's a small comfort to know that someone in Kansas City thought a lot of your dad and wept when he died, even though we had never met. I will remember him and think about him every time I visit one of the many gardens I had mentored in existence in his name. There are raised beds all over the country and even in a few countries that I had a hand in creating. One life touches so many others because your father touched my life by inspiring me to grow food in the suburbs. All of these gardens now exist because I reached out and touched others' lives. He deserved karmic credits. He will live on in all those gardens and on all hearts. Gene. I didn't read that one.
That's why we can't read them all.
I didn't read that one. So.
There's just, it's too many. So, Dad was really, the one that UCLA she was talking about was, I think it's a series on there that Jordan put up, because Dad went to UCLA a couple times to be guest speaker.
3 years in a row.
Yeah, they had him for their sustainability class, and there's one of his lecture up there about, and it was about seeds, and it was about, genetic diversity. It was about GMOs, the food, and what's going to happen to the food system. One of the things that he made me do, I had to do, as we all had parts in the presentations, and so I was gathering information to do like PowerPoint stuff. And so I think one of the statistics he wanted to show was, I think if in our grandfather's day we had a dollar's worth of genetic diversity in seeds,
apples.
In apples varieties, just cucumbers and corn and
beans,
just so much. But now, 50 years later, we only have 3 cents worth
left of that dollar.
3 cents left of that dollar. So what I did was to prove that point or to show the class. So we had put up a dollar and then 3 cents. And so, it's not about just teaching; it's about giving them the visual impact of like we're in deep trouble. We had a dollar 50 years ago. Now we're 3 cents. So what's it going to be like in the next 50 years? Mm-hmm. And so Dad was all about...
That's what he said about the tennis shoes. We have more choices of tennis shoes than we have of carrots in the store.
Yeah, so our priorities are a little bit out of place. And so Dad was all about trying to set the priorities straight in our, crazy world. And it started, and he believes it starts at home. It starts with food. Another favorite quote of mine that he did and I put on the website and stuff was progress starts with envisioning a new yet old lifestyle with home as central to all aspects of life, work and leisure, food and energy. So real progress means bringing the economy, beginning with the food economy, home again. So that's just as simple as just starting herbs in your windowsill, a raised bed garden, and what we did here at the homestead was not just about growing food, it's about building community. When we're hoping to share some of the community with our podcast folks is our music community, our activist community, our the green lifestyle community, the sustainable community, the fellow farmer community,
the kids.
And so there's a community that starts, and that pebble starts at home and then it goes outward. And so I guess our family, has just touched so many people that way, just by throwing the pebble out in the backyard and to spread.
I found some diary post from 2001 about, I'll have to read it and find it, and about how we started and what the issues were back then. And it was funny reading it 17 years ago, 16 years ago. Just, it seemed somewhat dated, but it's like, it rained today, we have a lot of tomatoes, bountiful harvest, can we sell the tomatoes too? And then we're talking about what we're doing, what the name of it, come up with a good name for what we're trying to do. So we came up with the jungle, like the jungle style gardening, and then it morphed. Came up with Urban Homestead in one of the family meetings. So I'll have to bring that up next time.
Because Dad had a homestead in New Zealand,
and
we were trying to recreate it. And so he said we have to call it something.
Yeah. So it was funny reading stuff, because like, it seems so simple. How much rainfall was, how much fruit we harvested, how much tomatoes we harvested. Still some of the issues we had. So the windstorm, so the day before, almost took us out of business. That was July. And then we had a rainstorm in July, which was pretty amazing.
That was in 2001?
2001. Yeah. So it rained today, and it's just funny reading that stuff.
Well, I go back to the journals, and people say, oh, yeah, you did such and such and such. And such. So I was like, I did? I don't even remember. It's like they know more than I do. I don't remember some of the stuff I post. But, yeah, we used to do a lot. Like, we were just talking today about, you know, just a picture's worth a thousand words. Just putting a picture on the blog and didn't have to say much, and just people were just so inspired and made their day. I would post pictures of our, what we ate, pictures of
soil
our planet, food or our planet.
It was exciting. Soil blogs. Yeah, just get busy.
Yeah,
for us, I think I've mentioned this in some media interviews. Dad, to me, this was the way I was raised. So it wasn't really special to me, because it was how we always did things. We always composted. We always... So I think I was kind of confused about when people responded to the internet. Because I didn't see it as anything special. Not that I'm not saying it was special, but it was like...
That's how you're raised.
Yeah, I was raised this way, so I was constantly eating kale out of the garden. And people would come and they'd eat the kale, and they're just like, this is so amazing. And I'm just like, that's what kale tastes like.
Oh, yeah, the people that bought the salad, yeah. They said it was like, the other ones are like eating cardboard. It's like,
I didn't have...
People literally said addicted.
Yeah.
To our
lettuce does have that when you break it. It has a little sap, which is a sort of an opium thing. But so a fresh one has high levels of it. It makes you relaxed and comforted.
So eat more lettuce.
I didn't understand, I would say, more of the other side. This was how we were raised. I always composted, recycled, never like obsessively turned off lights in a room.
Yeah. That's Justin.
So I would go, when I went to my grandmother's house, I was always flipping off lights. It drove her nuts. She was like, I want that light on. I want that room illuminated. And I'm like, people do this? There's nobody in the room. And so, you know, to me, it was a little bit more of a shock to see that we weren't normal. And then what's normal? What's relative? Yeah. But, you know, so when the kids in the neighborhoods, I would play with them, I just realized that more and more there was a disconnect that people had from the garden. It was natural for us to run around barefoot. Mm-hmm. It was just like, bare feet is just great. Until you walk out in the street and all the kids in the neighborhood would be like, oh, it's bare feet, and they would get horrified. And we're like, I never could understand what their problem was. It was that everybody had to wear shoes, and it wasn't something I knew that was required by society.
Still that disconnect is still, even you just see it last year at the farm stand, lady wanted a melon. You're like, it's not in season. She's like, no, it's not.
It's in big environmental health
store. Dustin's like, did you read where it came from? No.
Look at the sticker. Look at it's probably from Argentina.
Yeah,
I think she called back. Yeah, she
came
back and she was like, yeah,
said, you're right.
So, she thought because it was in an organic a store that provided organic produce, she thought it was local.
And in season.
And in season. And it Dustin just was like looking at her and said, no, it doesn't mean anything.
I can guarantee that wasn't local. I can pretty well guarantee that.
So I know, and I said, I remember my thing of when he said, Dad said after sitting around the table, well, just tell people what we do here. And I remember thinking to myself, why would people care?
The internet, I think, was one of them.
The what?
For a while, we didn't have the internet.
No, we didn't have the internet.
We had to go to the library, to the internet, and then we probably got dial-up internet. What do you think of the modern technology world that I was talking about in 1973? What do you think that?
In 1973?
So what do you think the modern technology world had made?
Well, he was working in computers at that time. He did
cell phones.
Yeah.
Twitter.
One of the reasons why he left the United States was he was a teacher, and he was teaching
high school.
Inner City High School, New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. And he saw at that time how society was going because he said, this is the next generation. And he, I don't know exactly what exactly was really bad in 1970s, but he said that he couldn't see that generation as the leaders of the country. So he saw there was a disconnect happening back at that time with the children.
That's why when we were homeschooled, why we got away with it, because it was illegal. Because that was the teacher.
Yeah.
That's a whole different story now. That's a whole nother podcast.
That's
a whole nother podcast of the when people say, they homeschool the kids and they're so, I did this. I was like, you have no idea. Mm-hmm. Of what the first homeschoolers had to go through, and now it's just like accepted and it's wonderful.
It's heralded, and
here I still have that hesitation. A hesitation, but it's just like I was homeschooling, and here I'm like they say, where'd you school? And I'm like that pause
because you couldn't say, you get hauled off to your dad, get hauled off to jail. I think one media asked, were you ever disadvantaged being homeschooled? And I said, I wasn't disadvantaged being homeschooled. I was disadvantaged by society's perception at that time of homeschooling. It wasn't that I was disadvantaged. I was disadvantaged because of what everybody else thought. What they perceived was wrong with me. So I grew up thinking
something was wrong.
And then you look at it and you say, nothing was wrong. But every time you were homeschooled, there was a blockage. So then being a young child, you took on that society. And it was their connotation that disadvantaged me, not actual homeschooling.
Because they thought you were stupid, basically.
Yeah. Basically, until I tutored a kid in the neighborhood. I was, 2 years older than he was, and I was doing his math, and I was tutoring him, and I'm, whipping through
2 years younger or older?
Oh, 2 years younger. I was 2 years younger, and I was tutoring a kid in math. And I'm sitting there going through this stuff, and I'm just like, maybe I'm not stupid. Wait, something's wrong here. And I also taught a kid to read. I was, younger than him. And I was tutoring kids in the neighborhood, and that was probably the only time I realized that I wasn't disadvantaged. It was everyone's perceptions that were making me feel disadvantaged.
So
I was tutoring boys older than I was.
No, but the homeschool experience. It trained us for this because it was always whatever. Our minds weren't put in a box and said, okay, at this age, this is what you're supposed to learn. This is how you're supposed to learn it. This is what you're supposed to do. It was whatever we had to do the basics.
Maybe what they call it nowadays is unschooled.
Yeah, I was definitely unschooled. I had no curriculum.
Us two older ones had more curriculum.
Yeah, me, I was just like,
free for all at the library or whatever.
Free for all. Here's the library. Go for it.
Well, they joked. The lady at the librarian, she goes, there she comes again.
They're like, start clearing out the tables for all my stacks of books.
And they said, you literally read the entire library, pretty much.
So, I think you read the library. I was like, probably I did.
We were homeschooled, you were unschooled.
I was pretty much unschooled. And it shows in how I approach things. Everybody, I'll, you know, not everybody, but you talk with a couple people and I say, oh, I want to do this. And they're like, oh yes, I have to take a class and I have to learn. And I'm like, why don't you just do it? You don't have to actually have that class. And they like rack up, and there's nothing wrong. You should
Because we teach classes.
There's nothing wrong with classes, but I would say more the mindset that too terrified to do it without a teacher showing them step by step. And it's like, I'm all for classes. Go educate, work, you know, expand your horizons. But it's this kind of hesitation to actually pick up something and try it. And, you know, we're not talking, you know, going to the moon and if you mess up a calculation, you know, you blow up the rocket. We're talking about, you know, plant that plant. If it dies, well, you can still go to the supermarket, you know. We're not on the Oregon Trail, you know, gonna starve out here on the Donner Pass.
We have fallback thanks to supermarkets.
We're in the modern society, we can still fall internet. Back and stuff. We have smartphones and apps and GPS.
Uh-huh. Not that that's
try navigating the city by the sun, and if not, pull up your GPS.
I think we talked about that before. But what do you call it? What perception? What's the thing called? Awareness of what's happening with your animals. Mm-hmm. We talked about that before. Or directions. Mm-hmm. Or you said we're going the wrong way.
Yeah.
But I think that it started homeschooling, and then we just, I think that approached, we tried to do 1 year, something new every year. So 1 year was solar, 1 year was biodiesel, 1 year was spray water, 1 year, a couple years was the harvest challenge, 1 year was a cob oven. So we tried to just do it, basically. And then if you failed, obviously you weren't good at it.
You try again. Failure was just a way of learning. That's how we approached everything. You know, it wasn't like your life was on the line.
Because I think one of the things was going back to our childhood was obviously Dad had a large family and was trying to make ends meet and some of it. So. My grandma bought us a bunch of bicycles, and they were old. They were getting old. So when we were growing up, and they started breaking down, and we didn't have any money to fix them, to buy any new ones. We didn't have any money to buy any new ones. So I do remember the first bicycle, we took apart, sanded, and repainted, and then reassembled it. It must have been 10 years old. It was pretty rough because it's, you know, it was the first thing taken apart and then putting it back together again. And then we started a little, so we painted and fixed up all our bicycles.
Mm-hmm.
And then the neighborhood kids wanted their bikes painted and fixed up. And they would just be amazed how fast we changed the
tires.
Just
to strip a bike and rebuild it.
Like that. And they're like, how old are you?
Justin could strip a bike and rebuild it instantly.
It's like, oh. Without even, not looking, but just without even reading anything. And they were just amazed how fast it was done. But one of the reasons why it was done is because we couldn't afford a new bike. So we fixed up our own. But nowadays, sometimes it's cheaper to buy new ones than to.
Yeah, it's kind of changed. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, that's like 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of weird that. Sometimes now it's cheaper to get a new one than repair your old one, which is
sad.
But we repaired a lot. Growing up, we repaired a lot of things. It was.
I think we ended up with 50 bicycles.
Yeah.
30, 40?
I don't know. They're still down there.
You're collecting them. Side of the road. Bring them home.
I remember the backyard when it was all concrete. It would be like all the kids in the neighborhood with like all these bikes, and Justin would be like redoing all of them. It was like a whole parking lot of bikes back here.
It was neat because you say, well, you didn't like the color, you scratched it, you beat it up. Take it apart and paint it again. Put it back together again.
And put the grease the bearings and tighten the spokes and
the warp
tires and I built the bike from scratch, basically from spare parts.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty neat to do that. But one reason why we did it because we couldn't afford a new one.
And I think that kind of skill in the hands was something that Dad kind of instilled in us, because there was a media piece that we were on about this preparation for doomsday. And I remember being on the phone with them, and I was like, we're not preppers. We're not these people that stockpile things and put away, you know, like water and all that. I mean, we have water. And one of the questions from the guys that were interviewing us was, where's your stockpiles? Or what happens when everybody knows that you're here and they're going to overrun it with guns and steal all your plants? They know you have food. And it was, to us, it was kind of humorous, because I think Dad's response to that was, yes, but they could take all the food, but they could take your land, but who's going to actually grow it again? I mean, it's like, if you stockpile canned goods, everybody runs and takes that, and that's food. You know, you go out here, and people are going to walk back here and say, I don't know what to do with this. Mm-hmm. There's nothing, we can't figure out what to do with this. Mm-hmm. And so my answer at that time to this interviewer was, it wasn't about stock. We'd have stockpiles. We do, you know, you do what you can. But it wasn't about stockpiling. It wasn't about, you know, getting all the MREs. It was learning the skills in your hands and in your head. So generally, yeah, people with guns can come take your property. Give me my seeds. Give me my animals. I'll survive. It wasn't about the property. It was about what was in your head and what was in your hands. It wasn't about stockpiling. Everybody's trying to protect the stockpiles when it was in your heart, in your skills, in your sense. You were the valuable, you know, asset. Not it wasn't the land. It was,
and it's not the stockpiles either.
It's not the stockpiles.
In a sense, I mean, ish. I mean, it's good to be prepared, you know.
Yeah, it's always good.
It's always going to happen.
But also that you could walk away from this property, find yourself somewhere else, and do the same thing.
That's, I think survival skills is more.
Yeah,
I think more valuable.
You know, all anyway seeds, always, and you know, and you can find yourself anywhere. And
we did that. Then we also did the
survival skills.
In the wild, what's called wildlife survival.
Yeah,
wilderness survival. Edible weeds, all that stuff.
Yeah. Make fire with
find water, find yourself out of the forest, build a shelter. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dad did that. He'd take us out there. He was like, build a shelter.
One challenge 1 year was to make fire out of something we found.
Like, yeah.
Make it from scratch.
Walk the mountains and find the materials you need to make a fire.
And the prize was a Swiss Army knife from the Boy Scouts or something. That was the...
Yeah.
We sat out there, we were huffing and puffing, and finally got the bow and drill working. It was a little ember, and we started a fire, got a bucket.
And there was a while there where Dad not refused to buy new matches. We didn't have matches in the house. If you wanted fire, you made it. And we did. We would have bonfires out here in the neighborhood. And Justin would sit down and start it with him. Ooh. And he'd be there, you know, doing it with the bow and drill and impressing all the people. And we'd have, like, bonfires every summer night.
Yeah.
Summer nights we'd have bonfires back here.
Put forts and tunnels and hogans. And
yeah, we built shelters back here. And then we did play stalking. We'd do stalking games.
Oh, the stalking game, remember?
You know, we had to sneak up on someone.
Tom Brown or Boy Scout?
It was Tom Brown at the time.
Creeping up on somebody with a back turn.
Yeah, creeping. We'd play that constantly, the stalking game. And we built deadfalls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think Dad was big in navigation, like in the mountains. He would tell us how to read the hillsides and find out where you are.
We went up there and we built some...
Hogans?
Yeah.
We built some lean-to up there.
We built a couple lean-tos up there.
Yeah. Take the podcast on the road one day and show our old homes.
We built one in a...
you learned to swim up there, right?
Yeah, we built one in a really rundown... Like, not rundown, it was like a wash of Pasadena. Justin and us.
We went. Kids.
Yeah, a couple neighborhood kids joined us. But we built this, like, things from... We collected and we
rocks.
Built this beautiful little...
Hogan.
It's called
a Hogan.
It's
a
lean-to or something. It was pretty awesome. We carved our names in it. And this is kind of like where Pasadena has the water supply. So every once in a while they dredge it out. And I remember going back after they had dredged it out. And the bulldozers had stopped on all sides. They were dredging it, and you could see they stopped. And they went very carefully around it. And they protected it, and I think they set up camp in there. Yeah, we just thought it was,
I think you said, oh, they're eating lunch.
Yeah, we thought it was the coolest thing because they were dredging all of Pasadena's water, but they kept that. They actually respected that. That was something special that we built.
It was funny because we would get, with the bicycle things, we get single speed 20-inch bicycles, bike uphill all the way up to the mountains.
Up to the mountains.
Build that stuff and then come down, and then we'd run into people, or we'd even go, then we had 10 speeds and we'd go up that. And we'd run into these guys with
a pink little bike, and
yeah,
I was
running into all these guys with these
souped up
fancy
shocks,
bicycles, and they're going downhill. And
they got dropped off and they went downhill.
We biked all the way up on a 2-bit 10 speed and then turned around.
Mine was pink,
and then we hit all the lights coming back. So just avoid, if you timed it right, you could nail all the.
I remember one guy, he did say something. I was going past him. I think he said, "That girl beating us on a crappy bike or something," because he was coming down with the full on his shocks, and I think he kind of stopped, and he called back to the guys, he's like, "That's not right." So, yeah, it's not.
But
all right.
We went through a bunch of bikes, but they were beaters, I guess.
They were pretty beat up. Mine was, that was a put together bike.
Yeah,
I'm gonna go.
You built that one for me. I think you gave it to me. Justin built that one, and he painted it for me. It was it was a nice. It had gears.
And the one you got hit by a car.
Yeah. And I got hit by a car on it, but that's another story. But, yeah, that I love that bike. Justin built it for me out of pieces.
Yeah. We're probably unsafe childhood, but no helmets, no.
Don't try this at home.
And we have a warning on this podcast. Maybe hazardous to your health.
We drank out of hoses.
We did have the one time I was, that was pretty stupid, but we built obstacle courses with the bicycle.
See, we had a whole concrete patio back here.
Yeah, so Dad bought the biggest place he could afford, a 30x30 patio, and we had all this stuff lying around, so.
Oh, he collected junk. So he piled junk back with junk. It was repurposed stuff.
So we had old, we'd play.
Railroad ties.
We had,
tires?
Obstacle courses,
we had tires.
So we would, some agility contest, we'd build an obstacle course and try to do it on a single speed bike. You know,
it's like BMX.
BMX.
Yeah, we tried the BMX, we would recreate BMX courses back here.
Yeah.
So and Justin built something.
That was probably the stupidest thing I've ever
done. He's like, watch this!
It was probably about this high. I put a plywood, and I just took off on that.
You probably was bad.
I landed on the mattress, though, right? Was it a mattress?
You expected to land on the mattress, but you didn't expect the wheel to stick. Because it's soft, and you went. The bike landed on the mattress. You did not land on the mattress. You thought you would land on the mattress?
I went too far.
No, the bike stuck the mattress, but it was soft, so it went through, and it flung you. The bike landed on the mattress. You did not land on the mattress.
I don't remember even being hurt. I just remember it was pretty rough.
We did, and then we opened it up for the kids, so we'd have BMX.
We'd have cardboard boxes go through a tunnel on a bike.
And then the bikes.
And then we put
we'd have to hop the tires.
Oh, yeah,
whoop-de-doos.
Yeah, whoop-de-doos on a BMX course.
And then the seesaw.
Seesaw, and get on a plank, ride a bike on a plank.
And the kids would line up on the driveway. We'd open it up, and we'd like do these courses, and we'd time them. And it was tournaments. I think it was like we had dead heats.
I think we put those packing peanuts.
Yes, we did.
So just one of the pranks we pulled on the kids was to put, we had a refrigerator box or a stove box, and we made, you know, like a curtain in there to ride a bike through it, and we put...
Oh, it was a bubble wrap.
Bubble wrap. Like packing
peanut. You said packing peanut, but bubble wrap. And they'd go and they'd freak.
So it'd be dark, and they'd go through a tunnel. So I guess that was our hazards, but that was pretty fun. But yeah, it was probably...
We got good on bikes. We were very good.
Very agile.
We could stand on the wheel and flip it around sometimes.
Except for that one climb.
Let's go down to the urban homestead, Pasadena by the freeway. Right down there on the urban homestead, Jules and his family are working away. Come on down to the farm in the city, back to the future, back to the plan. Right down there on the urban homestead, loving the life back into the land.
Oh, ooh, ooh, help the garden grow.
Singing,
oh, ooh, ooh,
we've got to help the garden grow.
The Urban Homestead theme song was written and recorded by Tom Fair. Thanks, Tom.
We've come to the end of this show.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Be sure to tune in again. Until next time, this is Annie,
Justin,
Jordan. Keep on growing.